for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama gave a speech last week highlighting the need to shift away from the long-running war on terrorism. But a more immediate crisis is at hand. The brutal battles taking place in Syria seem poised to spill over into neighboring countries with far-reaching consequences. Joining me to talk about what's happening in Syria and the long-standing debate about what the U.S. can or should do about it, Hisham Melham of Al Arabiya News Channel, Aaron David Miller of the Woodrow Wilson International Center, and Ray Taki of the Council on Foreign Relations. I know many of you have strong opinions. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Pleasure to be here, Diane.
Thanks for having me. I'll start with you. What about this news over the weekend? Is the war in Syria spreading?
It's already spilled over to Lebanon. I mean, last week we had more than 30 casualties in fighting between Sunni groups and Alawite groups in the northern city of Tripoli. There is a deep division in Lebanon. Lebanon, as you well know, has a brittle political system to begin with. It never recovered from its own civil war, and it's a very vulnerable country. And then you have an unstate actor in Lebanon, which is Hezbollah, that hijacked the whole country, and now it's playing an important strategic role in Syria, supporting the regime on behalf of Iran.
Do we know who launched the attacks into Lebanon?
Which attack?
Who killed the border guards? Who killed the...
No, we don't know. If you're talking about the three Lebanese soldiers who were killed recently, no, we don't know. They're investigating.
And who launched the rockets that killed the civilians?
As I said, there's an investigation going on. There are many groups operating. Hezbollah has many enemies in Lebanon. There are many people in Lebanon who believe, and in my opinion, rightly so, that Hezbollah is dragging Lebanon into the whole Syrian cauldron. And Hezbollah has alienated many Sunnis in Lebanon who are also... Many of them, or some of them, are volunteering to fight on the side of the rebels. So Lebanon is a bomb waiting to explode completely. And that's one of the reasons. And Lebanon is the weakest link in the five states around Syria. Jordan is vulnerable, too. And one of the reasons why people said, you know, we shouldn't get involved in Syria because we don't have strategic interests. The problem is that the United States has strategic interests and good relationship with the five states around Syria.
All right. And this morning... We heard that Jordan is turning away refugees, Aaron, because they simply cannot afford to keep them to provide housing, food, accommodations. How much of Syria does the Assad government control?
Well, I think a control, forget territory, which in a conflict like this may not be the critically important piece of it. This is a conflict in which the regime still maintains, by and large, the instruments of state power. Roughly, perhaps more than 100,000 forces. Rohokan guards the 4th Division, the Jaish al-Shabi, a determination to play on the fears of minorities in Syria. Yesterday, someone said that 20% of the Syrian, 20% of the public loves our dear president, 20% hates him. And the remainder simply want to preserve Syria as a nationally coherent entity. What that means essentially is that the Assad regime has the acquiescence of a far larger bulk of the population than people believe. And I think that's one of the keys to its staying power. But it controls the guns. It controls the CW, the chemical weapons. It has important allies, Hezbollah, Iran. And it has divided, self-interested, and dysfunctional international community, which has not yet and may not yet develop a coherent strategy with regard to intervention.
Ray Taki, to what extent is Syria getting support from other countries?
Well, I think there's every indication that Iranians have made a fairly substantial commitment to preservation of the Assad regime for reasons that are fairly obvious. Syria is their gateway to the Mediterranean, it's their link to Hezbollah, And as where Iranians go, you begin to see Hezbollah come in as well with its own commitments and so forth. And this is taking place actually in a region which is increasingly dividing against itself along sectarian lines. And sort of like the 1960s when you had the division between the Arab radical republics and the conservative regimes, except this particular division is even more troublesome because it's underpinned by sectarian identities as opposed to some sort of an imported ideology, which means all the conflicts in the region are likely to be more durable. Iranians will make whatever commitment they have to make, short of, I think, the deployment of forces in order to preserve the Assad regime. I think you see Iraqis being more involved in it. As Prime Minister Maliki always says, Syria is about Iraq. It's the Sunni bloc trying to reclaim a country because they lost Iraq to the seat of Shi'i power.
And what about outside support for the rebels?
Well, again, as has been suggested, you have various Sunni powers, Saudis, Qataris, and others assisting them. Quite possibly, I think you may see Europeans engage in that activity too. But as Aaron was suggesting, the international community support is halting, is tentative. In some cases, it's indifferent. And that's the problem you have with this persistence of stalemate.
But now you have the EU saying it's going to lift its arms ban on the rebels.
I'm not quite sure if that'll provoke, at least in the initial phases, a significant introduction of European support for the rebels, because there's a lot of divisions within the European Union. Most European countries don't want to be systematically entangled in this particular conflict, with some few exceptions here and there. And I'm not sure how much Europeans are going to do absence of some sort of an American signal on this.
Raed Taqi, he's senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. The question facing many, many people inside government and out is to what extent the U.S. and its allies should get directly involved in Syria's problems. Here we have Senator McCain making a special secret, not-so-secret trip, visiting with the rebels. What does that indicate, Hisham?
Well, it reflects John McCain's views on Syria. The United States should have got itself involved in the conflict last year or when it began, supporting the rebels after you vet their backgrounds and everything. And it has symbolic importance. The White House knew about it before, and it refocuses the attention on the conflict in Syria at a time when people are talking about the Geneva conference.
Do you think it's going to change anybody's mind?
No, I really don't think so. And I think John McCain probably knows that the American people, the public, is not interested in getting involved in this thing. The problem is here we have a conflict that is going to impose itself on you. And I see this president reluctantly, very reluctantly, being dragged into it, whether he likes it or not. If you have use of chemical weapons in a way that is outrageous, like the Halabja incident in Iraq in the 1980s, it will be incredibly difficult for this president, albeit he's very reluctant, not to intervene. So conflicts sometimes impose themselves on you. It's not a question of whether you like to. Nobody wants to be involved in another war in the Middle East. And obviously, nobody's asking the United States to send, you know, boots on the ground, to deploy troops there. But I think the United States should have acted last year. And let me say, this is in part a problem of leadership. There is no regional leadership. There is no European leadership. There is only American leadership, whether we like it or not.
John McCain has been pushing for a no-fly zone over Syria. Do you think that that's likely to be put in place, Aaron?
I don't. I think if and when the Geneva 2.0 fails, the administration will come under increasing pressure to do something
else. This is a conference that's going to take place in mid-June.
Perhaps. If the regime, the rebels, and the Russians, the three R's, can somehow find a way to reconcile in a way to
but
create...
But there's no indication that everybody will show up.
No, and look, peace conferences are good for one of two things, starting a process or concluding one. In this case, some of the parties don't want to start, and they have no idea how to conclude. No, I don't think McCain's visit will matter, although I think he feels strongly that this is a matter of principle. I just think that you have a president who has willfully avoided intervention and who has drawn a lesson from Iraq and Afghanistan. By the way, it is not boots on the ground. Nobody who debates these issues is talking about boots on the ground. The Iraq and Afghanistan analogy is apt in only one regard, and that is the relationship between the application of American military power and the end state. What is that relationship? And it's the uncertainty over that which, in effect, created, in my judgment, the disasters that are now Iraq and Afghanistan that are a cautionary note to this president.
Ray Tuckey, how do you see it? A no-fly zone?
Well, I think in one respect, Prime Minister Maliki is right. Syria is about Iraq because it's about Iraq for us. Iraq haunts this debate. What people don't want to acknowledge is the solution to the Syrian problems doesn't lie in the middle but in the extremes. On the one hand, you can negotiate with President Assad and in order to end the civil war with him actually preserving power. And you can talk about elections forthcoming. That's one extreme to end the civil war. The other one is a far more substantial American commitment, which would go beyond no-fly zones, beyond arming of the rebels. It could lead to deployment of special forces, mobilization of regional intervention, and so forth. Those are the extremes. That's where the Syrian solution lies. In the middle, in this murky zone of no-fly zone, yes-fly zone, air corridor, that air corridor, at this late stage of this civil conflict, it is unlikely to be resolved through such measures. Maybe a year ago, as Hisham suggested, such measures could have been decisive. Not at this point.
Right, Taki, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Short break here. We will be taking your calls, questions, comments. Stay with us. And we're back talking about the ongoing conflict in Syria, now spilling over into Lebanon, involving a great many people and countries. Jordan is now turning away refugees from Syria. We know that Turkey has thousands upon thousands of refugees within its borders. Aaron Dave Miller, talk about the different options that the Obama administration is considering or may have to consider.
I mean, I think you have a range of them. Humanitarian assistance, working with the opposition to try to create a more coherent identity, working with the Russians. All of these represent and the provision of non-lethal assistance to carefully vetted opposition groups. That's,
what does that mean, that non-lethal assistance?
Well, it's body armor, it's communications gear, it's vehicles. It's things that, well, frankly, are used in pursuit of a lethal conflict but may not be lethal in and of themselves. That notion is not going to significantly change the arc of this military conflict. So you're left with a variety of escalatory measures. There's provision of weapons and the right kind of weapons, the ones that we do not want to provide, anti-air and anti-armor to these opposition groups. There's the institution of an offensive no-fly zone along the Turkish and Jordanian borders, no-kill zones, actually, in which you wouldn't just protect incoming from incoming missiles you to actually go after Syrian military assets. And then there's direct intervention with airstrikes, cruise missile strikes against Syrian military targets and even leadership targets. All of these things could be combined into a very effective military strategy along the lines that Ray has argued. And I think if the president declares that Syria is in the vital national interest of the United States, he would, in fact, create a military strategy around it.
That last phrase is what's important here. If the president declares it to be in its own interest.
And means it. But we talk about this discussion with the whose point of departure is not the Middle East. It's the middle class. It's the middle class. The right perspective to understand why this president is behaving the way he does is the fact that he's a second-term president, one of only 17 in American history. The clock is ticking down on his presidency. His legacy is going to be a domestic one, if any, not chasing insoluble problems that cannot be resolved. You have the 2014 midterms coming up. The Democrats are vulnerable in the Senate. They'll probably not take the House back. This president is the extricator in chief. His mandate is to get America out of long and ineffective wars, not push America into new ones.
Ray Tuckey, would you agree with that?
I think the president's position is contested in Washington, but is politically unassailable in America. there is no clamor for intervention in Syria, irrespective of the humanitarian calamity. And I think the president alluded to that in his New Republic interview, suggesting there is all kinds of humanitarian crisis taking place in Central Africa with literal decomposition of states affecting large segments of populations. But there is no clamor in this country for that intervention, and that makes the president's position not politically vulnerable.
Sometimes presidents have to lead and have to determine what are in the best interest of the United States in the long run. And sometimes most people, most public opinions don't see the immediacy of the future. But, you know, but the job of the president is to defend American interests in the long run and to do the right thing. We did the right thing in Bosnia and Kosovo when there was no discernible strategic interest for the United States. I think we run the risk of allowing this conflict to fester if we don't intervene. And then you will end up with an something similar to Afghanistan in the 1990s when we left, and then the Taliban and all of these radical groups took over. The difference is Afghanistan is a landlocked country. Syria is right smack in the heart of the Middle East. It's on the Mediterranean. It's close to Southern Europe. It's surrounded by five states that are important. Their future is important for the United States. You cannot allow Syria to become the incubator of another generation of radicals. Already the radicals are in Syria, and they're going to hunt us. Last time I was here, I told you that the president overlearned Iraq, and I would repeat the same thing. He overlearned Iraq. His obsession is to end the war in Iraq, and he did. His obsession is to end the war in Afghanistan, he did. And last week he was telling us that the war against Al-Qaeda has to come to an end. The problem is I want that war with Al-Qaeda to come to an end, but Al-Qaeda has a say, unfortunately. You cannot declare that an end to a war when the other party is still shooting at you.
Aaron.
You know, I am a diminished minority, I think, in this town of people who are mightily trying to resist the uncertainties of American intervention. Nobody, since this debate has begun over the last 2 years, has identified a compelling strategy that would, in effect, allow the United States, using its military power, to affect the end game. Barack Obama does not want to get stuck with the check on Syria. And frankly, as an American, neither do I. It's not that I'm insensitive to the barbarity of what's happening. Upwards of 100,000 Syrians will be dead by the end of the summer. You've got radicalization, fragmentation. Syria is hemorrhaging refugees, internally displaced individuals. You're destroying a political culture and its architecture. You'd have to be a non-sentient human being not to understand all this. The question becomes, how do you create an effective strategy to essentially address the endgame? Ray is right, in my judgment. Either get in and do it in a way that will be not swift but compelling and effective, or stay out. do not talk about no-fly zones and vetting this group or that, because in the end, Diane, that is not going to work. And that is the problem. Ray, I think, is 100% right. Either stay out or craft a serious strategy, mobilize the allies, and as Hisham has made clear, lead.
Is there a strategy that you see that addresses the end game, Hisham?
No, nobody can tell you with any certainty what is the outcome, 100%. We did not have that certainty when we intervened in Libya. We did not have that certainty when intervened in Iraq and other places. You don't have 100% certainty. That's the problem. But leadership means that you make the right decision based on the best information you get, but what are your capabilities and what is your willingness to pay a price? Look, if we are not going to play a role on the international scene, then we shouldn't be in the business of being a great power. You know, sometimes I always say, call it the burden of leadership, call it the burden of empire. There are certain things only the United States can do. And let me remind people, most civil wars end with a victor and a vanquished. Not in a Geneva conference, they end with a victor and vanquished. The sad, ugly reality of Syria, there is an ugly civil war going on there, and we have to make a moral, strategic choice, which party we should support. This is like the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s.
All right, Hisham, 12 years of engagement in war, how are the American people feeling, Ray Taki?
I think with some measure of indifference, whether that's morally justifiable or not, we can debate that. Also, when Hisham mentioned Libya, a lot of people in the administration view Libya that has become an arms depot for radical actors across the region, not necessarily a story of successful intervention. And in terms of Syria, as Iraq demonstrated, and I don't want to stretch the analogy too much, the difficult task of American engagement becomes the day after President Assad is deposed. Because then you have to mediate these conflicts, these sectarian issues. You have to rebuild national institutions, which have been destroyed. You have to essentially bring it together. And that actually requires deployment of external forces to police this particular conflict. And it was with the regional forces, UN forces, American forces would have to be participant in that.
Here's a tweet. You mentioned humanitarian aid. A tweet saying, what challenges are associated with providing humanitarian aid? Why is there only a focus on supplying weapons to the region? Aaron.
I don't think there is a focus just on weapons. I think ICRC, Refugees International, a variety of other UN agencies are trying to cope with a situation that is simply overwhelming them. In addition to refugees, 2+ million who are outside the borders, you've got internally displaced people in Syria. The population of Damascus has swelled. If there is a struggle for that city, Jordan and Turkey may find themselves literally overwhelmed with additional refugees. So Lebanon. So I don't think there's an absence of focus on the humanitarian side. I think it's a logistics problem. I think it's a problem of access, and simply a problem of a society in the process of implosion.
And here's another tweet: what impact, if any, have Israel's multiple strikes into Syria had on the conflicts, Ray Taki?
I think Aaron can talk about Israelis more. I think Israelis are desperately trying to stay out of this particular conflict in some respects. And I'm not quite sure if the kind of intervention they're doing is necessarily helpful. But again, as this particular conflict goes on, and Hisham is right in one respect, it will suck in all the other regional actors who all have a stake in this. Iranians have a stake in it. The Saudis have a stake in it. The Turks have a stake in it. The refugees, Syrian refugees, now constitute like the fifth largest city in Jordan.
But despite all that, you do not see, or do you see, a role for the U.S. now?
I think if the United States wants to play a role, it has to play a decisive one, and I don't see the president or the nation mobilizing behind that.
All right. What about Israel strikes into Syria?
You know, I think the Israelis are part of the neighborhood. Unlike the United States, they can actually get away with a lot more in terms of taking military action. I think the Israelis have three red lines. Number one, cross-border exchanges over the Golan Heights, which had been the quietest space in the Middle East since 1974. The using or loosing of chemical weapons into the hands of their adversaries. And finally, transfer of sophisticated high-trajectory weapons from Iran via Syria to Hezbollah. Those are the three red lines, and I think the Israelis will act. I agree with her. I think they will act very deliberately and with a view toward trying to stay out, not get in.
All right. Here's an email from Paul, who says, as a retired officer, former Vietnam veteran, McCain is not representing the best interests of the American people. Syria will cost countless American lives, billions of dollars, with little, if not adverse consequences. On this one, Obama is right on target. Hisham.
Well, I disagree with that assessment. Nobody's talking about billions. Nobody's talking about long-term commitment.
But how
obviously,
can you know?
No. Obviously, this is a messy situation that is going to require regional intervention after, let's say, assuming the fall of Assad in the foreseeable future. It will require aid from the Europeans, from the Arabs, maybe from the Americans, the World Bank, rebuilding Syria. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to be neat. It is going to be messy. This is a civil war, and we've seen it. And countries go through difficult transitions after civil war. We've seen it in our own country. So anybody who thinks that there's going to be a silver bullet and an immediate resolution, you know, will be disappointed.
You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Jim in Kent, Ohio. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm very strongly opposed to our involvement in the Syrian civil war. I mean, they didn't get involved in our civil war. We have no business being over there and giving our tax dollars to people who cut out the hearts of their enemies and eat them on camera, like they did 2 weeks ago. It was NPR did not report at all, but BBC reported extensively. And I think that these people that we call rebels, who Kelly McEvers thinks are heroes, are really terrorists.
All right. Thanks for calling. Aaron, do you want to respond?
I mean, I think that comment reflects, by and large, a sentiment or view which is the prevailing one in this country. Governing is about choosing. We have debt, we have deficit, we have dysfunctional politics, we have a deteriorating educational system, we have a dysfunctional, deteriorating infrastructure in this country, and we're coming off the longest two wars, among the most profitless wars, I might add, in American history, where the standard for victory was never could we win, never could we win, but when could we leave? And this notion that extrication is something that we should use as a performance standard to measure the behavior of a great power, I disagree. Syria is not an opportunity. It is a trap,
right,
and it will prove so for the United States.
To Orlando, Florida. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Diane. I love your show.
Thank you.
My comment is, how about drones? This permits us not to have boots on the ground, but to participate in this in a meaningful way.
Great talking.
Well, again, it constitutes, as far as I know, probably drones are active in this conflict. But it constitutes one of the halfway measures we're talking about. It measures that will enhance the military capability of the rebels, may enhance some of their operational capacity, but are unlikely to nudge the stalemate in one direction or the other in a decisive manner.
What about drones, Hisham?
Drones should be part of a package, if you will, of military options that probably could include, in my opinion, the use of cruise missiles to disable command and control centers, to crater the few military airports that are being used now by the regime.
But
and
wouldn't that be inching our way in?
We did that essentially in Libya. We did not get involved. I think the cost was $1.5 billion. We didn't lose any men, and we changed the regime. Now, Ray was talking about the post-Gaddafi Libya, which is not a great place, but it's much better than Libya under Gaddafi.
Ray.
And for anybody to think that, again, transitional periods are extremely difficult, and you cannot just sit in Washington and say things have to be extremely neat, otherwise I will not get involved. Then we shouldn't be in the business of being great powers.
Right.
I think Hisham is right in one sense, that if we wanted to intervene in Libya, we should have made it more extensive commitment to post-war Libya, which we have not, because for all the reasons that Aaron mentioned. As Jack Kennedy used to say when people used to come to him about intervention in Vietnam, he used to say it's like taking a drink. The effect wears off, you have to take another one. Incremental intervention will get you in an incremental way and in an indecisive way at the end.
What about drones, Aaron?
It's a tactic, and it's a halfway measure. It would be part of a more comprehensive military strategy, which I hope the president does not adopt.
All right. And quickly to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Milo.
Oh, yes. Hello. My comment is it just seems that it's al-Qaeda versus Iran right now in there, and I don't think we should intervene. I think it seems like I heard a quote from Nasrallah, from Hezbollah, that he said kind of the same thing.
All right. Iran versus al-Qaeda. We'll talk more about that after a short break. Stay with us.
Can I address that?
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
A novel about love, friendship, the pursuit of perfection, and baseball. For this month's readers' review, The Art of Fielding by Chad Harbach. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. We talk about the ongoing struggle in Syria. Our last caller raised Iran and al-Qaeda, and you, Hisham, very much want to respond.
This is really a simplification of a very complex conflict. For the first 6 months of the conflict, of the uprisings, we've seen something very admirable. We've seen thousands upon thousands of Syrians in many Syrian cities walking peacefully in the streets, calling for political change, calling for empowerment, calling for democracy, for dignity, ending a brutal regime that's been going on for 50 years. The regime militarized the conflict. The brutal use of military power against civilians drove people to seek an armed response. This, unfortunately, opened up the gates for groups of radicals from the Middle East and from beyond the Middle East, from the Caucasus, from the Gulf, from North Africa, and in every civil war, sometimes you find quote-unquote volunteers. There were 45,000 internationalists fighting in Spain, including the famed Lincoln Brigade, the American famed Lincoln Brigade. 3,000 of them, half of them died in Spain. But to reduce the whole struggle of the Syrian people for dignity and empowerment and representation to a bunch of Qaeda, and just because one of them, a brutal animal, brutalized Syrian soldier that was killed, he should not become the signal or the symbol of the Syrian struggle for freedom and independence.
Great talking.
I think that's right. However, it has to be said that these sort of radical Islamist groups are always the most effective fighting groups, and they tend to therefore have the most presence in military campaigns. This is the kind of a problem, because they tend to be more ideologically committed to the struggle. The Syrian population's quest for liberation that Hisham talked about 6-7 months, was unfortunately subsumed in a larger regional conflict that pits various sectarian groups against each other. It's the Iran and Saudi competition that plays itself out in Lebanon, in Gulf principalities, and in Syria. This was has happened to the Syrian quest for having a more representative, accountable government. It's now something else. It now takes place in the Syrian context and the regional context, which has deformed what initially was a movement for a more accountable regime in Syria itself.
And here is an email for you, Aaron, from Dwayne in St. Louis, Missouri, who says, I think this panel has highlighted the glaring reality of this administration, which is its inability to lead or make the hard choices. This president seems disconnected or unwilling to look at the reality of being a superpower and the responsibility that comes with it, and is too worried about us acting like an aggressor.
Interesting comment. I think a case can be made that the lessons of Iraq and Afghanistan were overlearned. I think that's an argument.
How can 12 years of war be overlearned?
An argument worth having. Well, because you can draw the wrong lessons from a particular conflict. I mean, I believe that the same basic problem that we confront in Iraq and Afghanistan, we confront now in Syria, and that is the relationship between the use of military power and the deployment of American military assets and the political endgame that we want to achieve. I could not argue that the price we have paid in Iraq and Afghanistan was worth the return that we actually got. When America acts, it has to ask itself two questions. Not just can it accomplish it. If we wanted to unseat the Assads, we could do it. The question is not just that. It's what will it cost? It's the second question that always needs to accompany the first.
You said earlier you find yourself in an increasing minority. What does that mean? Are you saying that more and more legislators want to send us into Syria?
No, I mean, look, for 25 years, I was part of the private conversation at the Department of State. I'm now part of the public conversation, for better or for worse. And the reality is that the chattering classes, the commentariat in this town, I would argue, by and large, favor a much more muscular interventionist policy on the part of the administration.
Well, who are they?
Are they
the same people who took us into Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan?
Well, the same on Libya, perhaps, but not on Iraq and Afghanistan. It is a marriage of liberal interventionists on one hand and neoconservatives on the other. And they have found common cause. They have found common cause, in part because the neoconservatives despise Barack Obama and his foreign policy, and in part because the liberal interventionists are fundamentally and profoundly disappointed in a man they voted for who they believe have let them down, particularly the interventionists, their responsibility to protect groups who see that we are, quote unquote, leading from behind, an unfortunate use of words for sure, abdicating our responsibilities.
Ray Turkey.
There is a story in the Washington Post today about the liberal interventionists not necessarily coming along on this particular conflict in the numbers that you have seen before. And in terms of the political parties, if you recall, Governor Mitt Romney's position was not to arm rebels. He was the standard bearer of the Republican Party. his position was that this, the president has mishandled this, but I'm not for arming the rebels. Aaron might be a minority in this city. He's well within the vast majority of the American people. In Cleveland, in Chicago, in San Francisco, Aaron's position is almost redundant. Only in this city, and increasingly, I think, the politicians are sensitive to what's happening beyond Washington. As I said, at the end of the day, Mitt Romney represented the Republican Party in the last national election, and his position was not for intervention in Syria.
All right, let's go to Newport, Rhode Island. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Diane. I'm just wondering whether the panel would like to comment on the recent Russian statement of their intent to deliver surface-to-air missiles to Assad. And is this not part of the Russian chess game on the international scene? And now they've put the USA and their allies into check.
What do you think, Hisham?
This is typical cynical Putin-Russian foreign policy in the Middle East. They really don't care about the suffering of the Syrian people. They believe that we need to deny the United States another victory, and they feel that the fall of the Assad regime will give the United States another victory after Libya. This is really not a principled position anyway. They are interested in cash. They are interested in having access to a naval base in Syria. And I think they are gambling that, and also because of they wanted to believe the fiction that this is a struggle against the extreme Islamists. And we've seen what they've done to Chechnya and what they call their own radical Islamists in Dagestan and in Chechnya. So it fits in with the view of Putin's view of the world. And you know, it's sad when you look at what Assad did to some of those great old Syrian cities, and you look at what the Russians did to Grozny, the capital of Chechnya, you can see a lot of similarities.
All right, to Austin, Texas. Patrick, you're on the air.
Oh, hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question actually regarded what one of the gentlemen said a moment ago. He was talking about how it began as a peaceful uprising and how it kind of morphed into this horrible thing. The gates were open and all these horrible, you know, jihadists came in, and it's kind of gotten out of control. Don't you think that if Assad is ousted, since they're the best fighters, they'll take over? And, I mean, wouldn't that be bad for everybody in the region? Like, aren't the first people they're going to go after Israel?
Right, Turkey.
Well, if and when President Assad leaves power, the Alawite minority is still there. It has to have some sort of a role in the – but then you're going to see the second phase of the civil war, namely how do you reconstitute national institution from these debris that is left, from these animosities that have been honed, from these atrocities that have been committed. And that requires a substantial degree of intervention by the international community, not just in terms of provision of economic assistance, but also in terms of troops to patrol these. I mean, one thing we saw in Iraq is deployment of forces was necessary in order to mediate these conflicts and have some sort of a national institutions come to power. That's the next and more protracted phase of the civil war as it goes on.
So how would the Syrian relationship with Israel look from that perspective?
I suspect for quite a while Syria is going to be involved in its own internal struggles, as Iraq is, as opposed to fashioning some sort of a foreign relations. It's going to be involved in its own conflicts and its own struggles, and all the other actors are going to be part of that. So you're going to have to see – you won't necessarily have a coherent Syrian foreign policy for some time to come.
Has Israel played any role in keeping President Assad in place, Aaron?
Only if you argue that somehow the Israelis should be involved in an active or proactive effort to undermine the Syrian military and defeat him. No, I think the Israelis recognize their own intervention in Lebanon way back. Hisham knows this story as well as I do. In the early 80s, I think cautioned them about the consequences of Israeli intervention, and to do essentially what we tried to do in Afghanistan and Iraq and Lebanon, which was nation build. This time around, a Christian minority that never had the confidence of the majority of the Lebanese people. So no, I think the Israelis learned their lessons the hard way between 1982 and 1984.
I mean, if I can address the issue of radicals winning. Because I don't want the radicals to win, I'm hoping that the United States will level the battlefield, so to speak, as they say, the
but
playing field.
Can it?
Yes,
can
I think it can. I think it can. If this great power cannot do something like this to influence events on the ground in a country like Syria, then, as I said, we shouldn't be in this business of being a great power.
Do you believe if there were the will on the part of the American government and the American people that we could go in and defeat Assad?
I think, as Aaron said, we have the capabilities. If the United States wants to deploy its forces, it can actually replace the Assad regime. And if it wants to engage in occupation of Syria, it can potentially at some point create some sort of a national institutions in that country. We're just not in a position where we want to do that. There's been a lot of discussion here about Syria. There is a humanitarian crisis here, and human beings are dying in large numbers. They're going to die more, and eventually they're going to die at the hands of chemical weapons. As the conflict goes through, you're going to see both sides using more extreme and radical measures to break the stalemate. And unfortunately, this conflict has come to a country that's war-weary. And to be frank, there is not that many strategic interests that are identifiable and discernible to the mass of American people as they look at Syria. And that's just the way it has come to about. Syria now shares a distinction with a lot of African countries that have gone through their conflicts with American indifference, European indifference, and so forth. So it takes its place in that long gray line of crisis that essentially American people are not paying attention to or concerned with just because of their own predicament and as a result of 12 years of conflict that this country has undergone in the Middle East.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Indianapolis. Good morning, Charles.
Good morning, Diane, and hello to you and your guests.
Thank you.
I would like to know, what is the United Nations appraisal of the current situation, and wouldn't it be more appropriate for the United States to accomplish its goals through that organization?
Aaron.
Sure, but the problem, unlike Libya, is that two members of the permanent members of the Security Council, the Russians and the Chinese, have no intention of acquiescing, let alone actively supporting a UN resolution to allow the United States to do that or to create a multilateral coalition in order to do that.
All right. And to Washington, D.C. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Diane. I was just wanting to make the observation that the extraordinary amount of media coverage of the situation in Syria and the coverage on NPR in particular seems in some ways to be contributing to a climate in which there may be an inclination to do something, to intervene militarily.
Tell me how you see that, Michael. Explain that.
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that it's an extraordinarily tragic situation and that a lot of people are being injured and killed by the regime, and this creates understandable humanitarian concerns.
But are you saying that you believe the media should not be covering it, that NPR, the BBC, the CNN should not be reporting on it?
I wonder if maybe it's just a question of perspective, if maybe a little bit less would do.
Aaron.
Look, there is no gold standard for objectivity in human beings, and there's certainly no gold standard in the media. There are imperfections and biases in coverage of any issue, and it goes up and down given what's happening domestically. Newtown, the Boston Massacre, at the Marathon, you have all of these events which can, in fact, eat up airtime and crowd Syria. But Syria is a story that will continue. It is a wound that continues to bleed. And ultimately, even though I'm against intervention, I suspect the United States, if Geneva 2.0 fails, we will be drawn in probably along the lines of providing some lethal assistance to the opposition.
We have an average of 200 people being killed on a daily basis in Syria. We have not seen massacres on the scale of Srebrenica, you know, with 7,000 people, but with the potential use of chemical weapons, and there are indications that chemical weapons have been used by the regime, we are waiting for a huge catastrophe to happen. So you expect the media to ignore this? I mean, obviously, sometimes we ignore it because of other things, because we are concerned by immediate challenges in our lives here. But this is a huge story that deserves a great deal of media attention and scrutiny.
Do you believe in the end, as Aaron has said, that the U.S. will go in some way?
Even this reluctant president will be forced at one point to intervene.
Ray Takey.
Yeah, I do. I agree with that. I think it's going to be in the context of Geneva. American policymakers love two-track policies. They always say if we're going to negotiate, we have to have a robust military component to it or a complement to it. So I suspect in context of Geneva, the president would prefer to lead from behind. So he'll press for Europeans to begin to arm the rebels. And so, and gradually, I think you'll see some sort of an American arms provisions to the rebels. That's going to prove indecisive. There'll be another show about what to do after that.
Ray Takey, Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Aaron David Miller, Vice President, Distinguished Scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center. Hisham Mellem, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Arabiya News Channel. Thank you all.
Thank
so
you.
Much.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.